My name's Dan Delaney, and on behalf of Healthscape, I'd like to introduce Alexis Levy and Casey Bartolucci. And we are all part of the leadership team of Healthscape Advisors, which is a management consulting firm and advanced analytics organization that's actually right down the street. So we're excited to be in town for once. It's nice that you guys come to us and take advantage of our location here in the Midwest. As Dennis mentioned, we're really excited to share with you the preliminary results of our survey on value-based care. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what the survey is all about and our methods and the participants, and we'll get into the findings shortly. I wanted to spend just a brief minute providing some background on Healthscape for those of you who are a little bit unfamiliar with us. And so as I mentioned, we're a consulting firm here in Chicago. We are 100% healthcare focused, and we are helping our clients, as you might imagine, with some of the most vexing and challenging problems that are out there today. And as we all know, there are many. It's a very complicated industry. And the clients that we're helping are a mix of health plans, provider organizations, specialty health organizations, essentially the ecosystem of companies that surrounds our core payer and provider clients. And we help them with their developing their strategies, enhancing their capabilities, performance turnaround, partnership development type endeavors. And in particular, we've been immersed lately, really over the past 5-6 years, in the area that we affectionately call in our firm value-based transformation, which, as we all know, is this journey to shift as the payment model shifts from the fee-for-service legacy system to fee-for-value. And with that comes significant attention to the upfront design of these models, the financial structures, and equally importantly, the operating models that need to transform on the fly as you guys are attending to your day-to-day business. And it's a very, very difficult challenge, and probably one of the preeminent challenges for our industry, as you all know. And so we've been helping clients all across the country formulate their strategies and execute. And that ultimately was the genesis of the survey idea that when we approached the HPA, because it's not so often when you're immersed in something that you have a chance to kind of pick your head up and say, how are we doing? And we thought it would be valuable to you all to give you a snapshot, and that's all this is really, a snapshot in time, your perceptions, your feedback based upon the way that you guys answered our survey questions of how you're doing along a number of different elements. And so to that end, what we're going to cover today, just from an agenda perspective, is I'll round out my introductory comments here by giving you guys a little bit of an overview of the methodology that we use, the participants of our survey. And we're excited about that piece because it's not just HPA. We were able to engage with many other health plans across the market. So we have a very good cross-section that will allow us to compare you guys to the rest of the market on a number of different elements. But we'll talk a little bit about methodology, and then we'll jump into results. And we've divided the results section of this report into two sections. The first one is high-level, kind of macro-level, value-based landscape findings. And then we do a little bit of pivot, and we dive into the operating model. And we ask you guys questions around the effectiveness of various functions that are really critical towards driving success in value-based payment models. And we'll share the results of our survey along those elements in the second part. And then we'll close with some key actions for consideration for the HPA. Based upon our findings, there are some interesting themes that I think are relevant for you guys to take back to your home plans. Obviously, these are thematic. They're not specific to any one plan. All the results here are aggregated, so the responses from each individual plan are anonymous. So some of these may apply to you, some of them may not, but I think from a global thematic perspective, I think there may be some relevance. We're hopeful there's some relevance for your home plans. So that's how we'll close the discussion, and that's our agenda for today. A bit about our focal areas. What do we test What do we look at as part of the survey? Really three main areas. The first is your perspective, is your perception of value-based payment models. So what drove your organizations to adopt these models? How long have you been in value-based payment models? What's the impact and influence of government regulation, particularly macro and other CMS programmatic drivers that may influence the models that you develop? We then get into what types of models are you deploying? What's most prevalent? Is it pay for performance? Is it global capitation? Is it something in between? So we have good results to kind of show you what's most common. And then we provide that same perspective by market segment. Are there any differences by market segment in what you're deploying? And then we'll make the third focal area is where we make our pivot. We'll look inward and we'll get your view around what's working and what are some areas of opportunity for health plans and for HPA plans to really focus on as you're evolving your models to drive a greater level of effectiveness. So those are the three main focal areas that we have that we tested in the survey. So how do we go about our business? For those of you who participated, it was really a two-part process. One, we had a fairly simple online survey, about 15, 20 questions, and that was the basis for collecting data. And then we followed up once we got your survey results with interviews. And we had, on average, about a 45-minute interview with leadership across all respondents to really bring to life some of the responses. And obviously, a little bit less scientific on that end, but it helped us to capture some interesting case studies that we'll share with you guys today, just to give examples of and to bring to life some of the findings that we have. And through that, what we uncovered, and I think another a theme in our findings, is a wide variety of approaches being deployed. And as we all know, healthcare is local, and there's a lot of factors that drive how you need to deploy your resources and your strategies, and they may differ from one market to another. So there may be some interesting learnings that you guys can get from what others are doing. In terms of who participated, we're excited about that. We had almost 40 health plans participate here, and a split right down the middle, 50% HPA, 50% non-HPA. The latter category is predominantly composed of Blue Cross Blue Shield plans and other regional health plans across the country. And we've covered about 40 states, so we have a broad swath of the country. And those plans cover about 200 million members in aggregate. So we feel confident that this survey is certainly a good representation of value-based payment models for our healthcare system here in the U.S. Certainly there's, we didn't cover the entire country, but we have a pretty good sampling to give us some good indicators. So that's a little bit about methodology and who participated. And then lastly, this thing started with, we had a hypothesis. And ultimately, the survey was designed to test that hypothesis that HPA plans or provider-owned health plans have an inherent structural advantage based upon the relationship with your provider owner and the integrated delivery systems that are tied to that model. It's structural from the standpoint that the barriers that are typically there for traditional health plan provider relationships that are more arm's length in terms of access to data, potential for integration from a care management perspective, and certainly alignment on vision and strategy, theoretically, the barrier should be lower. And so our hypothesis was put out there to test that notion and really to ask you, what do you think? Do you believe that you guys have a strong effectiveness in this area because of the way that you're built? Are there some challenges? And we really set out to answer that question. The questions below 1 through 4 on the slide, I won't repeat because I've gone through most of those. But that was ultimately the vision that we had, and we were curious, and we thought it'd be interesting to you guys to see if that hypothesis, that hypothesis is true. So that's the background on the survey. And with that said, I'll shut up and turn it over to Alexis to begin summarizing some of our key themes and findings from the results.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Can folks hear me? It sounds like the mic's working for me as well. Okay, so we thought we'd throw a whole bunch of data at you for our first slide on an early Friday morning. But what we wanted to start is to share some of the more interesting statistics that we saw. And what we did is, and these statistics are really representative of the major themes and discussion areas that we're going to dive into later on in the presentation. And we really looked at our data and our qualitative findings along two dimensions. The first is, when we had answers, did we see major differences in the answers between provider-sponsored HPA plans and non-provider-sponsored plans? And sometimes we did, and those things were very interesting to us, and then we'll point some of those out to you. And then the second dimension we looked at is for plans that reported to us that they've seen success in their value-based payment models or positive outcomes, and we define that as a plan reporting to us that they've seen improvements in both cost and quality, you know, what were the aspects of those plans that led them to be successful? Because I think those are all the goals that we all have for these value-based payment models. But what are the things that perhaps led some plans to report positive outcomes while others did not? So those are kind of the two major dimensions that we'll dive into. And then I think just a couple statistics to point out to you on the slide. You know, we do see about, of the plans we spoke to, 40% of them talk about at least 25% of their reimbursement being tied to value-based payment. If we think about CMS's goal, where they talk about, I think it's 80% that they want to get to in the next couple years. We didn't talk to national health plans like Aetna, Humana, United, and that was a bit purposeful because we thought some of their comparisons, it's a little bit like comparing an apple and an orange if we're going to talk about what's Humana doing versus a provider-sponsored plan. But we did want to think about what we see these national plans saying in their investor reports and out to the street. And you know, we certainly see the national players pursuing these aggressive targets as well. Aetna recently reported that they have about 50% of their reimbursement in value-based payment. Anthem said they're about 60%. So what we're seeing from provider-sponsored plans and more regional plans is or only 40% are at 25% of their reimbursement. So still some room to grow to kind of get to some of those goals. Only about a third of the plans reported that their value-based payment models are in risk-bearing type arrangements, which was interesting to us, and we'll talk about that in a little more detail. About a third of the plans that we talked to reported that they felt that they were ahead of the market, but interestingly, of those third that said they were ahead of the market, two-thirds of that third, so the vast majority of the plans who said they were ahead of the market, were not provider-sponsored plans. And we also did notice some differences between provider-sponsored plans and non-provider-sponsored plans on how they report success and cost and quality. And we'll talk about that a little more. The last thing probably to note on this slide is that 67% of plans said that value-based payment was of high strategic importance. So that's certainly a commonality that we saw across provider-sponsored, non-provider-sponsored plans. You know, the majority of folks reported to us that this is a pretty important initiative for their organization. And if we think about that a little more, you know, so as I said, 70% of plans said it's really important. We wanted to dive into that a little bit more and try to understand, well, why did plans get into these models in the first place? And this is one that we explored through our interview findings. And as Dan said, you know, when we talked to everybody, it really was very specific reasons. Every market's different, every plan is different with their capabilities. But we tried to synthesize all these different reasons that we heard into some overarching themes. And you know, there were a small percentage of plans who said it's either not important to us or the providers in our market just aren't ready or aren't interested in value-based payment, and so we're not interested in, you know, trying to push the providers to do something that they're not ready to do. So that was a small portion, about 20%. The majority of folks that we talked to sort of gave kind of a broad answer around cost is an issue, fee-for-service is unsustainable, that's not going to help us control costs, we have to get off the fee-for-service, you know, hamster wheel. So that was kind of the majority of folks that we talked to when we said, why are you doing value-based payment? Another small portion sort of talked about federal or maybe local government mandates, state government mandates that were driving them towards value-based payment. But interestingly, the smallest percentage, when we really kind of drilled down into it, sort of gave a rationale for value-based payment that was very broad and strategic and enterprise-wide and talked about not just cost and quality, but tied in things like product and sales and marketing and growth strategies. So the smallest percentage of plans are the ones that were perhaps thinking about value-based payment from what we call this enterprise commitment perspective, which was interesting to us, and I think we'll have some implications.
And Alexis, one case study on that that we felt was interesting that just gives you an example of how a plan that that's in that 15% bucket is really developing a strategy that is central to their enterprise. What we learned from them is they had an objective when they got into value-based payment models in a big way to reduce their premiums on key market segments by about 15 to 20%. And that was their ultimate goal. And so it took them, as they described it, of course, they have to have all the key elements in place with their provider partners. But it took not only the classic care management and network management functions to make it work, but it was the launch of a product, the design of a product that had the right benefit structure and the right network structure to go with it, to drive volume to all the right places, to essentially compensate their provider partner. And this was a non-HBA plan, but compensate their provider partners for a volume for a unit cost type exchange on a fairly statewide basis. And so this is a game-changing strategy for this company where it wasn't kind of a one-off, we'll do a little bundle payment model over here, or a P4P. This was a bet the farm type of approach, very significantly linked to the development and launch of a product they wanted to be really a premium differentiator to drive increased market share. So that's an example of one case study that we heard from an organization that was really kind of doubling down on value-based payment models to make it central to their overall strategy.
Do we have a question?
Do you want to repeat the question?
The question was, is each plan weighted to one, or did we do some kind of weighting based on size? Answer is we did not. So, yeah, when we kind of looked at what everybody told us, this is kind of the distribution. We didn't give someone extra weight if they have 1 million lives versus, 100,000 lives.
Oh, hang on.
Sure.
You want to repeat that question, too?
The question is, do we define what a value-based payment is? And we did. And we looked at it from across the continuum. So really, and we'll share that with you in subsequent slides, but it starts with across the continuum from less risk-bearing to more risk-bearing. So on the far end of the less risk-bearing continuum is pay-for-performance. And then we moved across shared savings models with upside-only type arrangements, shared savings with an upside-downside component, so that's when you're starting to get into shared risk. Bundle payments follow those same models, of course, but they're going to be tied to more episodic or episode of care type programs. They can have upside-only or downside as well. And then eventually getting into capitation or full capitation with a global budget. So it comes in all slices. And when we asked our respondents to tell us, what types of models are you in, those are the choices that we gave, so that there was enough where people could at least find something that was hopefully somewhat similar to what you may be offering.
Okay, so maybe that's how Aetna can claim 50% value-based payments, because they've got a lot at on the light end of the scale.
That's right, and that's why we ultimately try to provide some gradation to it, so that Alexis mentioned a stat at the beginning where I think it was about 33% of respondents were in some type of risk-bearing arrangement, and that was defined as shared savings with an upside and downside, and then all the way over to global capitation, and that's how we looked at that. Yeah, because if you start to include things like paper performance, everybody's been, they're going to be pretty close to 70-80% pretty quickly, and not as meaningful.
But I do think that's one of the insights from the survey and doing this work is everybody has a different definition, and everybody looks at even some of those phrases. Global capitation means different things to different people in terms of what's included. So I think one of the insights is value-based care, value-based transformation, fee-for-value is distinct to each organization and how they're defining it and looking at it. Mm-hmm. And so probably a good transition to something that maybe helps bring some standardization to it, and that is MACRA. And I think, you know, the tagline to MACRA and its implication on fee for value is it's a mixed bag. So as we went through the actual conversations and the interviews, this wasn't necessarily a question on the survey, but we knew it was a topic we had to cover qualitatively, and how is this influencing fee-for-value strategies? And really, we found it's a mixed bag. There are folks who are really focused on MACRA and how do they develop their fee-for-value strategies, the continuum and evolution of the providers across the fee-for-value continuum, and aligning it to where MACRA is going, and seeing that really as an opportunity to ride, if you will, the rails that CMS is laying out and pushing down. The other side of the continuum is folks that say, I hope this will go away, or I don't believe this is going to stick, or it will evolve in some way, that tying my strategy to something that I'm not convinced is going to stay in its current form isn't of our best interest. And I think it's an interesting dynamic that's in the market. And I think people fall on both ends of the continuum. I think there's folks out there who have, as Dan gave an example of, folks who have bet the farm, who are just, you know, I've already made my strategy, I've placed my bet, and I'm going to continue down that path, and I'm not going to change it necessarily for MACRA. I will look to make sure that as that gains traction and really stabilizes, that I am positioning my providers for the requirements of MACRA, but not necessarily immediately going back. I think there are others who are still in the formation of their fee-for-value strategy, who are really trying to develop it in alignment with MACRA and ensuring that they're considering both the MIPS program and the alternative payment programs and making sure that it's going to help their providers move along that continuum. The other one that I think is out there kind of tangential to MACRA is CPC Plus in some markets and folks that have adopted it. And I think it's much more of a, obviously, a primary care-focused strategy. And for some of the respondents that are in those markets, really trying to take existing PCMH programs and evolve them into the requirements of CPC Plus. But I think at the end of the day, the insight around MACRA and CMS's, if you will, kind of participation from a Medicare fee-for-service perspective is really driving and helping force the market along maybe faster than it would go absent its involvement and engagement.
A good example of that, just to give a little bit of an illustration, is we spoke with one plan that has a pretty robust PCMH primary care type program, and currently it's based on sharing savings that a PCP might have with their attributed members on the member's total cost of care. But right now it's an upside only savings arrangement. There's no downside risk to the provider if the total cost of care for their attributed members exceeds the set target. So this plan is thinking very strategically about, well, we have MACRA coming down the pipeline, and if we remember back to Thursday when the folks from Epstein Becker Green talked about the technicalities of MACRA and the all-payer model that's coming down in, I believe, 2021 for the performance year 2019. This plan is looking at that and saying, you know, trying to communicate to their providers, look, if you shift to a downside risk arrangement in this primary care program and we set it to be meeting the technical thresholds that CMS has for nominal risk, now you're moving yourself into that alternate advanced payment model framework and getting you out of the MIPS track. So this is a plan that's looking very, very specifically at their program and at MACRA and trying to use MACRA as a way to kind of accelerate their program to help providers assume more downside risk, which has been a goal for them, but it's been tough to get the providers to be willing to do that, and so MACRA could be a good catalyst for that.
And I think one of the things that's consistent for some of the survey respondents was the requirement to be able to go out and really educate the provider community and tie that program of MACRA to the existing programs that the plan has and the value proposition of moving in this direction towards MACRA with the programs that the plan is launching. So a big education effort and really tying the value proposition together.
Yeah, and it depends on the providers in your market too. We did hear that large systems are a bit more in the know about MACRA and maybe need a little less education, whereas smaller providers, you know, probably are a bit more in the camp that Casey talked about maybe hoping it goes away. So I think similar to, again, what Lynn and Bob talked about, I think there's a good opportunity here for health plan education and support of providers with that, especially if you have a strategic goal for value-based payment that you're trying to achieve.
So to the earlier question, and you just beat us before we got there, certainly one of the questions that we were asking and trying to gain perspective on was, what is the most prevalent model in your value-based payment models today? And I think what we tried to do here is get an understanding. While many of the organizations we spoke to had a variety of programs launched, what we're trying to understand is where is most of the action, if you will, in their value-based payment models. I think the takeaway, you know, there's a host, and Dan kind of walked through them earlier across the continuum here on the X-axis. But what I would say is, you know, clearly on the left side of this chart here, about 58% are either in a P4P type model or a shared savings upside only. And that is, you know, I think, you know, one of the challenges that MACRA pushes the industry is to really get to downside shared savings, if not further along the continuum, into capitated arrangements. And so we did find 33% of the plan cited risk models most prevalent, either shared savings, upside, downside, a capitation, professional services only, or global capitation. And I think, you know, one kind of note here about global capitation and professional capitation, I think one of the things that we've seen in the industry is challenge from plans and the ability to administer, and that being one of the big hurdles that's out there in terms of moving not only a provider network or community along the continuum, but the plan's ability to actually administer those types of programs. And so really started to see a division as we talk through these models with the respondents in terms of some that would view capitation in a bucket of a prospective payment, much like a Medicare Advantage plan receives a payment from CMS, that type of capitation payment down to the provider, and others who would look at global capitation and call it global risk, where it's really a budget that's set and in really establishing a target that then is measured kind of on a retrospective basis. And really the distinction so often in the conversations was driven by capabilities, the ability of the plan to really have the competencies and the systems to administer a global capitation payment versus having to do a global risk where you're setting a global budget and tracking the provider against that.
I think that's a good point, because I would say most of the plans we talked about who are on this end of the spectrum wasn't necessarily that they migrated to it. That's kind of where they started at, which has sort of been their model. And so to Casey's point, they had those capabilities in place. They have the systems. They have the overall underlying infrastructure. It's not necessarily that they started on P4P and now have found themselves on the right-hand side of the spectrum.
Yeah, just in general, any idea like on this graph and some of the other ones on what the mix of primary care versus specialist is? Is this predominantly primary care, or is this a mix of capitated specialists in a plan and primary care being more upside numbers?
Yeah, I think typically what we would see in the capitation models is primary care capitation as the focal point, except for those where large systems have necessarily taken on kind of in a global risk, if you will, strategy with the payer.
I think a theme we heard that we don't explore here but in this presentation, but one that I think we'll look at as we kind of continue to refine our findings, is the issue of primary care and specialists. And we heard a lot of challenges from our survey respondents on how do you engage specialists in these models. A lot of the models that we talked about, I would say, are more primary care based, and kind of figuring out how to get specialists, sometimes how to get facilities involved in these programs is, I think, a challenge that a lot of plans are trying to do, especially those who maybe have pretty good programs on the primary care side. Now they're trying to think about how do we evolve it to the specialists.
And I think on the specialist side, the conversation would often go to bundled payments or episodes of care, which have their own unique challenges in terms of, I think as we talked with folks, does it really move the needle? For those that have gone out and tried to do bundled payments on ortho, is it really going to change, in some of our conversations, is it going to change the price point to our products? So is it really going to move the needle? And so what we've seen like on bundled payments and episodes of care is often a kind of a reactionary value-based payment model, a reactionary to either CMS driving and requiring, which is then bringing providers to the table asking for bundled payments or episodes of care, or really employers driving it because they've heard that they should be seeking bundled payments as a way to control cost. So I think I would really put, and it's on a slide in the next couple slides, and bundled payments, episodes of care, is really one that kind of is not a part, I would say, broadly of anybody's value-based payment or transformation strategy. Rather, it's a reactionary kind of necessary evil because of other forces in the market.
Now, at the same time, we have a view that you have to have a portfolio. So you don't have to have all of your structures in one of these models. Episode and bundle programs can be one element of a broader portfolio of value-based models. And it's and you have to have a portfolio view. And a lot of folks that we've talked to are thinking about or are using bundle payment as a tester as they make the evolution from a shared savings, you know, retrospective-only type model to a prospective capitated bundle model before they really go big, you know, on global capitation or a broader shared risk arrangement. So they do become interesting because they could be smaller and more targeted. They could be useful in testing the waters around the ability and the receptivity on the market around bearing risk.
Questions?
Hi. So I was just going to follow up on you made a reference to the fact that the movement from shared risk to global cap is heavily based on, I think, your data capabilities, right?
Right.
And are you going to, I don't want to jump ahead, but are you going to talk at all later on about sort of the data points necessary to do each of these?
We are, yep.
Okay.
Yeah, we have, just to give a teaser, I think, we are firm believers. I mean, our firm's perspective is that to really get any behavior change, the market has to shift to the right, and there has to be a greater level of risk delegation to the providers. Because shared savings upside-only models have been, you know, a good put your toe in the water, but there's not a lot of data out there that really shows that they are consistently effective in driving savings and outcomes. I think, you know, the industry is starting to accumulate data, but like anything in any business, financial incentives are going to drive behavior change the most. But with that comes organizational readiness. And we're going to talk about that in the last section.
Do you have a sense, as you move over onto the upside downside and all the way to global risk, what the demographics are of those types of organizations? Are those vertically integrated? Are they at least provider hospital aligned? What do those look like?
Yeah. I was scouring the data last night because I was thinking about this is a good question. And so interestingly, we did not see a big difference between provider-sponsored and non-provider-sponsored plans in the assumption of risk. That was a hypothesis we had going in, that we would see that, and we didn't. So especially on that shared risk upside downside piece, that doesn't necessarily, being a provider-sponsored plan, doesn't make you more of an adopter of those models. The global capitation ones, though, do tend to be an arrangement. As I talked about, that was the structure that the plan had. It does tend to be more provider-sponsored affiliated plans, and that's kind of the way they architected and organized their plan from the get-go. That was kind of my comment earlier around this wasn't that they started out in, you know, P4P, and now they found themselves in global, you know, capitation. But I think that's kind of the point that Dan was talking about the portfolio approach and the evolution. We know we're not going to jump from the far left to the far right. I think the movement to risk will be more somewhere in the middle, so not that it's impossible for plans, but it's kind of finding the right capabilities, the right models, using external influencers like MACRA to try to start to shift in that direction. And in a way that providers feel comfortable doing so, which we'll talk about a bit when we talk about the capabilities needed for value-based payment. Okay.
I get the provider-sponsored versus non-provider-sponsored. I'm wondering if you went to the level underneath of that to understand the demographics of the healthcare system.
Yeah.
And how it, because you can have a provider-sponsored plan that's doing, that's not connected to the rest of their system,
right,
that's providing services for other health care organizations. Do you know anything about the healthcare organizations?
It's a good question. I don't know. I think that's a great follow-up because I don't know if I have that off the top of my head. We have the information to be able to break down that 13%. And I think that's, you know, as we start to round out the results of the survey, I think that's a great, you know, click into that bucket mm-hmm. to see the composition.
And I'd echo that point because this is our sort of preliminary initial sharing of the findings. So as people see things, and we appreciate that comment, there's things that you're interested in that next click, bring those up to us. You know, I'm happy to see all the participation. These are the things we'd like to hear, because we'll talk about where we go with the survey finding as we round out the presentation. But if there's additional cuts of this data or other things that you would like to see, let us know, because we want it to be most valuable and useful for you guys.
Any other questions right now? So the other thing I'll say is, you know, that was kind of a snapshot in time of where people are at with their value-based care models. The other piece that we've seen in the survey and in our work is what's driving the strategy, right? Is it a value-based transformation, part of the organization, network evolution, or is it line of business? And I think as we transition to this next slide, I think it ends up being an important distinction. One thing we've seen with one of the survey respondents is the line of business, and in this case, the kind of case study, a Medicare Advantage line of business within a plan, very focused on transitioning their network to risk. I think there's a lot of, in Medicare Advantage, of course, a lot of stories out there about what Humana is able to do and what they've been very successful at doing in terms of transitioning risk to providers and primarily through primary care. And so I think there's, as you think about the continuum and the strategy, there's a close relationship that needs to be developed in terms of not getting too far out in front of where your providers are at in terms of their capabilities, readiness, and also making sure that the value-based transformation strategy aligns to a line of business strategy. And that will get into some of the following slides when we talk about benefits and products as well, because it ties closely. But to this slide, in terms of, you know, what were the market segments and what were the where those prevalent models existed as we look across, what stuck out to us, and you guys have the slides and you can look at it, but kind of for the purposes of a conversation here, what stuck out to us was, and maybe not so surprisingly, was Medicare Advantage was the line of business where we found the most prevalence of shared risk, upside, downside, or capitation. And I think that has a lot to do, obviously, with the products that are in market, a lot of HMO-based products where there's greater alignment between the member and the provider, as well as the ability to have consistency. You don't have the churn that you may have on the commercial book with members. So there's the persistency of the member staying with the plan makes it also a much more attractive and likely place to be able to administer those types of value-based payment programs is the Medicare Advantage space. I think the other side is, and this is a place where we spend a lot of time in the survey and with our clients talking about, is how do you really develop value-based payment programs for PPO products and in the commercial space. And it creates a great deal of challenge. And we look at that as, to Dan's earlier point, it's about the portfolio, right? It's not going to be the right strategy to try to force everybody, every product into a global capitation. It's just probably not going to align with where the market's at. And so on the PPO commercial side, there's much more of a kind of a portfolio view, and you get much more into population health models that probably fall on the prior slide to the left of that kind of division of sharing and downside risk until the industry is truly evolving into something else where you can create greater likelihood of success in moving to the providers to financial risk.
Couple others. Yeah. Of course.
Sorry, I'm having a hard time reconciling the global capitation with the ASO.
That's not allowed. No hard time allowed. Alexis, you want to take that one?
Yeah. So the way that this question was structured when we talked to folks is we asked them, by your line of business, what's the most prevalent value-based payment model that you have for one particular line of business? So the previous slide is just overall, across everything in your market, what all your lines of business, all your market segments, what's most prevalent? This is a bit more of a drill down into, you know, for a line of business, what's the most prevalent model? So we did have, you know, it's probably a small number, but a few plans you sort of talked about we have, use this for all our market segments, which would include ASO. But again, I think that it may be an anomaly. We may have to look at that and say, did they fill that out right? Because I do agree that does seem to be at odds. This is kind of what people were reporting. I think it's probably more likely that they use global capitation because of their structure across everything. Maybe they're not even in ASO, and they just kind of checked everything. So we can look into that a little bit more deeply. It's a small percentage point on there. So certainly not a theme or something we would see more broadly in the market.
We knew someone would ask about that, though.
Appreciate you looking at the data deeply. There's one other question in the back. We're hogging up the microphone, so sorry that it takes a little bit.
So you were guessing why they had gone with different models with the different lines of business. Did you actually ask them why they had selected the different models in the different lines of business? I was just curious.
We did. Those are the things we probed in the interviews that followed up. So a lot of the times it was helpful because we would have the survey results before we did the interview, so we could ask questions around that. But we did try to ask questions about, are you doing things different for different market segments? That's where we got to this idea of MA pushes more towards risk-bearing pieces because, one, with MA, the cost issue is a much bigger imperative in MA, perhaps, than it is for other lines of business. So we heard a lot from plans that we need to do something to help our providers move the needle more on MLR, and we think having some kind of risk piece in that is important. The other thing with MA is the revenue side of it, stars and risk adjustment. So moving to a risk-based arrangement, especially where it's on MLR or involves premium in some way, a percentage of premium type arrangement, really helps to move the needle on that. So we did try to explore with plans, is there something about your particular line of business or market segment that's causing you to pick one model over another?
And there are two other points on MA that I heard as feedback on the interviews. One is certainly growth. The whole market is bullish on that demographic because it's a growth opportunity. And then the second theme was stability. With all the uncertainty as to what's going to happen with the next wave of potential health reform, this is the one market segment that is potentially relatively unscathed when you compare it to, the individual market segment in Medicaid. So those were just some additional qualitative points of feedback that we got through our interviews about MA.
And I would say the other thing, while this represents kind of current state, I think as the conversations got into future where people were wanting to go, the alignment back to macro was a big part of that, and being able to take their provider network on the Medicare Advantage side and bring it along with where macro is going is a big part of the future kind of vision for many of the respondents.
And on the commercial side too, we did hear themes from many plans about potential opportunities with large employers in the market, sometimes their own health system owner or just other large employers that were driving them to try to do some kind of a more risk-based arrangement, more in the large group fully insured or in the self-insured side of the world. So I think MA came up a lot as a theme, but we also heard similar comments on the commercial side as well. A couple other comments or themes to talk about before we transition into the operating model side. We did talk about how long plans have been in value-based payment. If you remember back to the first slide, we had about 70% of plans that have been in value-based payment for 5 or more years. And so we tried to ask ourselves the question, is longevity meaningful to plans as they think about their success in value-based payment? And to answer our own question, and not surprisingly, the length of time that you're in value-based payment is highly associated with positive outcomes in value-based payment. More specifically, of the plans who reported that they are seeing success in both cost and quality, 93% of those plans have been in value-based payment for 5 or more years. Don't have the stats up here, but plans who are in these models for a shorter period of time don't see similar positive results. So certainly, as we know, as I think makes sense to us, these two, we do need kind of a runway for value-based payment. If we break that down a little bit more in terms of longevity, 76% of non-HPA plans have been in value-based payment for 5 or more years compared to 61% of HPA plans. It's not a meaningful difference if you look at it on an absolute plan side. But what is meaningful is if we then looked at those plans that have been in the market for 5 or more years. So of those non-HPA plans that have been in the market for 5 or more years, around 70% of the non-HPA plans are saying they see success, improvements in cost and quality. By contrast, of those 61% of the HPA plans who've been in this for 5 or more years, only 40% of them are reporting that they've seen success in both cost and quality. So that was a bit more of a meaningful difference for us, and one that we wanted to look at in a bit more detail. So again, while we're seeing both HPA and non-HPA plans being in these models for longer periods of time, we are noting that plans are reporting, you know, there's a difference in what we've seen of plans reporting between HPA and non-HPA in terms of how successful they've been, which begs the question of why.
Hold on.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. So are you going to go there today, or is that a follow-up survey?
Well, no. We're going to get into it, and I think this is thematic of a comment we made earlier around the organizational transformation that has to happen to really support these types of models in a meaningful way, and that takes time. Now, do we root cause this answer as part of our survey? No. We have some theories as to why it's the case, and certainly I think this creates a great opportunity for follow-up to understand, you know, if you've been in these types of models for 5+ years and they're still not working, you know, it's a signal to, you know, what do we need to look at? And so we have some thoughts around that as we pivot to the operating model piece of this in a couple slides, and some interesting insights from actual survey results around your views on what's effective and what's not on a function-by-function basis. So,
okay, good.
But we haven't necessarily, you know, we don't have a specific answer as to what may be driving that.
We have some hypotheses around it that we'll get to in a second, but I don't know.
Okay, good.
If we
I didn't want to jump the gun. Yep. I also am curious how, I'm always suspicious of survey results, and so how suspicious are you specifically of the validity of the responses from HPA participants versus none?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there's some science to the survey, but you know, it's all self-reported results. We haven't gone and looked at, you know, we'd love to get all the data to validate whether there were truly strong cost and quality outcomes, but we're relying on respondents to tell us whether that's the case. We thought there might be a little bit of chest thumping from the non-HPA, you know, they're overrepresenting their success, but it's, you know, there's some limitations to the way we went about doing the survey, just in terms of it's all self-reported answers, right? And so I don't know if that answers your question, but I think there's some caveats to come with this. It's not what I would call 100% scientific, and we had, you know, people fill out a survey, and that was the data that we got.
Yeah, I agree, it's valuable. Yeah. It's insightful. It's not necessarily conclusive.
It's directional, yeah. I think, and thematic is really the main find.
And then in this, pardon me, maybe I'm ahead of you again, but do you get into the question of why a health plan would want to have a value-based contract and why a provider wants one? Because I think sometimes they're aligned and sometimes they have different, very different goals.
It's not something that we survey, but I think as we get into the next section, we can certainly give some of our perspectives on that.
Just the other thing on, you know, the results of positive outcomes, I think the reality is it's still a very small sample, right? For folks that had launched these programs of 5 years, you're still only looking at a small number of, you know, year over year performance results is fairly small. We're not talking a 10-year view of results at this point. And I think Dan's point too, I think many of the folks we were speaking to are the folks who launched the programs and are definitely biased to what the results may say or how they've looked at them. So, and I think,
yeah, and I can tell you from our own experiences, one of the bigger challenges that people have is measurement. And it's trying to understand how you're doing is one of the many challenges. And so I think there's a discount factor towards when people are reporting doing well or doing not. I mean, do they really know, and how are they measuring it? And is the model set up in a way that is effective to really give you a good empirical result? I think there's mixed bag on that.
what I don't think we're seeing is differentiated price and outcomes from a product perspective necessarily from the programs yet. I think that's obviously where people are trying to go. Dan, to a comment you had made earlier,
right,
of can the programs actually lead to a lower price point in our products? I don't think anybody's really shown that as the ultimate outcome that everybody is seeking from these types of programs.
Yep. Right, and there's different ways of looking at that. Certainly, you can get into the cost equation by measuring, you know, key utilization drivers that you guys undoubtedly all look at. And on the premium enhancement piece of it, I think the measurement and these programs and more sophisticated arrangements are certainly focused not only on critical cost management, but revenue enhancement around risk adjustment and stars. And certainly those are measurables as defined by the CMS model that do make it a little bit easier within the more regulated markets to gauge how you're doing.
Do you have a sense in that data as well, the 69-70% compared to 40 that claim a positive outcome improvement, of what the quality component actually is? Quality can mean anything from here to yon. And at least my experience with the large national players is their definition of quality is something that most providers wouldn't necessarily put in the quality bucket. It might lead to cost management only, but it wouldn't necessarily impact health outcomes or other positive sorts of factors. So do you have any sense of that differential there?
The quality is... it would be as the plan defines the quality for their particular program. Now, the large nationals aren't part of our survey responses here. Again, we're more focused on provider-sponsored and regional. But, you know, the question is really for the quality and cost objectives that you have for your program, have you been successful in achieving those through your value-based payment model?
I think that's irrelevant. In my opinion, that's probably a relevant impact to my perception of 70% versus 40%.
Sure.
That's a really good
insight.
A fair point. And it's this one of these, it's the balances in doing a survey where you're asking 70, you know, five questions versus 15, and also putting a more prescribed, here's our view of quality out there that might be different. And what we found is, to your point, there are different definitions of that, you know, depending on who you talk to. So it's certainly a more simplistic way of capturing people's view of if they're doing well or not in that domain.
It would be an interesting, you know, you could do this data in so many different ways, but it would be fascinating to know what are the quality measures that you have for your program and being able to compare them between them to kind of, to your point, it sounds like maybe some plans are holding themselves to a more clinically based, higher standard of quality than perhaps others are. The last piece, so this gets back to the question we had about why do we think we see this difference, even if we have some caveats about the difference. You know, it is at least directionally a difference. It's a self-reported difference. It's something that we wanted to explore a little further. So this gets into a finding that we saw about what we call provider panel or wallet share. So this is related to the question we asked plans about what size, you know, what portion of your provider network's panel do you make up as a health plan? And for HPA plans, we asked that about your provider owner or IDS. For non-HPA plans, we asked it about kind of your network more broadly. And generally, we saw the non-HPA plans reporting so we have about 62% of them saying that they are at least 25% of their provider network's panel. That's compared to 44% on the HPA side. So it's probably not surprising. Generally, we would see that some of these plans make up a bigger portion of the provider's panel. This was notable to us, though, because as we get into this next section about capabilities and the operating model, you do have to be what we call kind of that tipping point or a significant enough portion of your provider's panel to have them be willing to do the change management to their clinical workflows, to their model of care, in order to do the things that we need to do on value-based payment. And if you're a smaller percentage of the panel, it's harder to get their interest and get them to make those investments. And we did note that, you know, the plans who have that what we call higher wallet share, the greater percentage of their provider's panel, they reported that they were more able to achieve cost and quality outcomes. So it is something we noted. You know, we do want to say, though, it's a structural issue. You know, it kind of is what it is. You can't change the size that you are. You can't change the percentage of a provider's panel that you are. So we did want to note that it could be something that's driving some of our findings, and it's potentially a limitation. But it's a nice segue to us as we start to think about the operating model and what are the things that we can control within our plan that might help us to potentially make up for this challenge that we might face because we're smaller and a smaller percentage of our provider's panel.
And just one thing I'd add there from at least one of the survey respondents was the way they saw their wallet share changing by entry into new markets, whether that was increasing their penetration in Medicare Advantage or entry into Medicaid, where they saw all of that kind of from a big picture strategy perspective, getting them to a higher wallet share to help them address what is our value-based transformation model. And it really leads to a question of, are you going to do market-based transformation or practice-based? And so for this respondent, their vision, this is probably a 5 to 10 year vision, is if we can get north of 50% of the wallet share, then we may be able to execute on a market-based transformation. Simply stated, back of the napkin concept that they were floating is, can we then adjust the whole market on a fee schedule down whatever 5-6% as an alternative to going through maybe some of the more complicated mechanisms on a practice transformation where you're trying to get those that are ready and willing and sophisticated enough to really do capitation and find the change. So I think it's an interesting strategic concept that's out there for those that are trying to kind of, if you will, capture more of the market to then determine what their strategy is around value-based transformation.
Okay, so why don't we segue into the second part of this? And as Alexis mentioned, when we talk about structural advantages and disadvantages, she outlined what I would call a market structural disadvantages that smaller plans may have. And to reiterate her point, it's not something you can just flip a switch to increase market share or the wallet share of your provider partners. But the other structural piece that we look at is, of course, operating model and organizational competencies. And this gets back to the hypothesis that I outlined at the beginning of the presentation, where it is our position that provider-sponsored plans and HBA plans are uniquely positioned structurally to execute. And this may be an area of emphasis to really offset the market structural disadvantages that many smaller plans may have. To set this up, I wanted to, I'll try to be as brief as possible, but introduce a framework that we put out there. And we have a white paper that we released about a year ago on our thinking here that we can send to you all. But essentially, what you have in front of you is our view of the foundational and execution building blocks to drive highly effective integrated models to support value-based payment. And when we surveyed you, we deconstructed this, and we asked you questions about the different elemental parts that you see here. And now I'm going to put it back together before we show you the results. At the foundation of this is governance and financial alignment. And when we see successful plans in the market coming together in any form, and some of them are more formal through joint ventures, and some of them are just traditional arm's length type arrangements, first and foremost, it's absolutely critical to have strong governance. And that can happen in a formal basis. It could be a board. It could be a joint committee. It could be an operating work group composed of clinical, operational, and financial representatives from both the payer and provider side. And it's absolutely critical that at the formation, particularly where you have larger scale and more complex arrangements, that you have that type of management structure to set the vision. And the vision around, as we talked about, the roadmap to risk. And a lot of times where these things can become dysfunctional is if there's misalignment there. The pace of change, the resources that both entities need to devote, whether it's capital or human, need to be committed to along a roadmap so that the capability evolution can follow the financial risk delegation evolution. And without that foundation being set, it's our position that this whole thing can crumble. The other foundational elements are are certainly traditional health plan competencies. You see network management there and product and benefit design. The distinction in these types of models is the interlinking of the two. And what we see is often as opportunities that are not fulfilled in the market is looking at those two things separately. So when you're developing a smart value-based network strategy, which is certainly intended to drive clinical volume to high value, efficient providers, power and the ability to do that is absolutely enhanced with smart product and benefit design that drives member behavior and incentivizes people to take empowerment over their own health and make good decisions around that are, you know, cost impactful to them. And as we see plans that are evolving along this continuum, they are beginning to launch products that are very central to their value-based strategies. So we look at those two things as very intertwined. That's the foundation. And then we get into execution. And at the core of this, it's all about integrated care transformation. When we queried you in the survey, we called it medical management. But when we're forward-looking, when we define where we want the market to be, we define it as integrated care transformation. And the feedback we got around what's happening there, and Alexis will do a little bit of a deeper dive into it, you know, there's a lot of different strategies and tactics that are out there in terms of level of delegation, of health plan resources to providers, clinical programs that are being deployed around transitions of care and pharmacy management and lab management and emergency department avoidance. But all, you know, the common themes are a partnership type approach to developing what those programs are and a rollout of those programs that are aligned economically to transform the way that care is delivered. And the enabling factors that surround care transformation are, of course, data. And data enablement and analytics is absolutely key, and we know that there's significant investments being made in the market to really drive and get data real-time into people's hands to affect clinical decision-making, as well as to give you insights into how you're performing. And that's a key enabling factor. And then member engagement, often certainly an area of emphasis, but often an afterthought when you think of some of the core competencies that require that are more complex or more traditional type functions of health plans. And member engagement is absolutely key to drive different types of care models that are being deployed out there. So you add it all together, those are you know, what we believe to be the aspirational market or model. So then let's get to some results. What did you guys think? As we looked at, we have a number of different takeaways here. The first of which is when you look at what we'll define as the healthcare management suite, so medical management or care transformation, network management, and data analytics. By far and away, this was an area that was viewed by respondents as either moderately or highly effective. So, and I think this was what came out of this, and Alexis, you could keep me honest here, is that when we look at HPA versus non-HPA, the viewpoint, of course, in confirmatory of our hypothesis is that especially care management data analytics is that you guys view yourselves as even more effective than that 60 to 70% would show. And there's a disparity between HPA and non-HPA on that front. And so I think that does demonstrate that some folks taking advantage of that structural advantage that I had mentioned at the outset. Now, by contrast, areas of opportunity, product and network design is absolutely one. I think the majority, when we looked at the different types of products that were deployed by respondents, the majority were in the broad PPO bucket. And certainly that has to be part of the product portfolio, but there are challenges, especially in trying to make value-based payment models work because of broad networks. You have less control over where the member is going, of course. It makes it much more difficult to engage. No PCP assignment. And with that, we saw the most prevalent types of attribution model or assignment models or tying members to these arrangements are attribution as opposed to a PCP assignment. And we think there's opportunities there, again, through product design to better align members to product and to PCPs, which would then enhance the engagement with the patient and the member. And then on member engagement, I'll give you an example. You guys probably saw the press release 2 days ago, Cleveland Clinic dipping their toe in the health insurance waters with Oscar. And their partnership with Oscar is all about, or one of the elements, is all about member engagement. Oscar brings their member platform, mobile, transparency in terms of, more transparency in terms of cost information, outlining medical options. They're trying to enhance the member education and member decision-making process through this partnership. And that's just a good example of 2 days ago where the market may be going, and an area I think, certainly based upon survey results, that's an opportunity viewed by the respondents as less than effective in supporting these types of arrangements. And Alexis, I think you have an interesting case study as well.
I think another plan I thought was very forward-looking in this area of member engagement is that this doesn't have to be limited to the traditional kind of value-based contracting functions. So in this plan, when a member calls in and they put in their ID and the IVR, it immediately pulls up the member's risk score for the customer service representative to see. So even if the member's calling because I lost my ID card or, is this doctor in the network, the CSRs see gaps in care. And actually, the highest risk members are routed to a different navigation team that will try to help deal with, remind the member of, you're due for this mammogram, or you haven't been to see your primary care physician, or, hey, I saw that you were in the ER, what's going on, or are you following up with your PCP? So it's this idea of engaging with the member, making every call count with them, even if they're just calling because, they, again, can't find their ID card. It's engaging more aspects of the plan. So obviously a kind of infrastructure required for that strategy, but one that they think is really important and shows that, engagement of the members more than just an issue for medical management or the network folks or the provider-facing folks to deal with. A couple other building blocks to touch on in more detail. I won't belabor this one, but, network management is the one that plans reported as being the most effective in supporting their value-based payment goals. But interestingly, we saw a significant difference here between HPA and non-HPA plans. Generally, in the other building blocks that we'll talk about, medical management, data, it was more evenly split between HPA and non-HPA. This is one, again, where we noted that non-HPA plans tended to find this a bit more effective. We think this could be tied back to, again, that wallet share, market share issue that we talked about earlier. Interestingly, though, it does seem to go both ways. While we may not be a big enough portion of our provider's panel, when we asked HPA plans, are you involved in value-based payments with just your owner, or are you doing them with other network providers, over three-fourths of the respondents said they're doing value-based payments with not just their owners, but other network providers. So it's kind of this two-way street of needing to get a little bit broader in the value-based payment piece. On the flip side, when we talked about integrated care transformation or medical management with folks, we did see kind of a growing body of evidence that HPA plans are starting to make some strides and progression towards this integrated care and may have some advantages than non-HPA plans do. Again, as Dan pointed out, we saw plans doing this in a variety of different ways. There's certainly no one-size-fits-all, but a couple themes that we saw that we wanted to call out with this. The idea of delegation of care management is a big one that we talked to a lot of plans about. I think there's consensus that care management is better done at the point of care by a provider versus telephonic versus just mailing people stuff. So we want to try to delegate, but there's challenges with that. Maybe we have NCQA accreditation issues and we can't fully delegate, or maybe we don't trust that the providers are really going to truly do care management exactly the right way. So, while we want to delegate, we can't totally delegate. And in fact, even plans that were fully capitated still had to do, that we talked to, had to do some medical management functions internally because of accreditation issues. So we know we can't fully delegate. So we see a lot of opportunities in embedding to help with this issue. I know we did some case studies earlier of folks who are embedding. We see a good amount of that as a way to kind of bridge that gap. Interestingly, we are seeing more embedding of not just nurses, but social work, behavioral health, those kind of personnel, which kind of fits along that whole social determinants of care theme. That's been a big one in this conference.
One example, and I, excuse me, I had talked about the barriers that non-HPA plans have to, just based upon their traditional relationships, to transitioning resources from a health plan to system. And one HPA plan we talked about indicated the transitioning of really their entire population health management staff over to the system side. And, you know, the ease of doing that really stood out to me. As we talked to our other clients that aren't provider-owned, I mean, that's a long negotiation and one that can't happen just like that. So I think that's just another small example of less friction, smaller hurdles to be able to supercharge some of those care management, care coordination efforts on the HPA side.
And as we think about this embedding issue, you know, there's kind of this challenge of, well, if I do this, you know, is a provider going to accept it? And it has to be enough of their patient flow to be worth it. And so this kind of gets this idea that we may need to, especially for cost management, we have heard from some plans, and actually both big and small, that it's okay if a rising tide lifts all boats with this. If we put people in and we know the things we're doing are going to benefit other health plans members, that's okay to us, because we will see the cost management piece accrue to us too. And especially in a population like Medicaid or exchange, where we talk to plans, there's so much churn in that membership. Another plan's members today are probably going to be our members in the future. So especially if we're thinking about models for that population, you know, doing things like this, even if it's going to address not just your membership, is more acceptable because we know that will help us achieve the goals that we want to, and really will be the only way to get kind of that adoption from the plans, or excuse me, from the provider to make the changes that we need them to make to accept it. So if kind of that barrier of, well, I don't want to put our resources in there if it's going to benefit other payers, you know, that's some interesting feedback that we heard to think about. And the last one is kind of our case study about, you know, patients listen to their providers. We did see a lot of plans doing things where they're kind of white labeling their activities from a care transformation aspect, as though it's coming from the provider. So calls being made on behalf of the provider, mailings coming out on behalf of the provider. And certainly there's no reason why a blue plan couldn't do this. But again, I think the barriers to doing these things as a provider-sponsored plan are lower for you. And so that, you know, is another theme that we heard that may be a good opportunity for a provider-sponsored plan to maybe overcome some of the structural limitations that we talked about last time.
So we briefly touched on data analytics before, and this is just going to scratch the surface, but a couple of survey results summarized here. First, about two-thirds of the respondents believe that data analytics was effective at supporting value-based care, and I think kind of pausing on that is probably an important opportunity to understand that. I think, you know, one thing that we've heard and seen is, you know, when there's limited to no data sharing, a little goes a long way. And I think what we see here in this response is that little has been effective, and there's a lot more opportunity, and I think we're really just scratched the surface at really how effective data sharing and analytics can support these value-based transformation models. But I think what we see with this result is the limited that's been out there has been impactful. The second data point, again, 68% view that they are able to effectively measure. And so this is back to the other point that, you know, it's a question of what you're measuring and what you're intending to track and monitor. I think for, we'll call it Gen 1 of these value-based transformation models, people feel like they've been able to effectively measure what they've been intending to see outcomes in. Anecdotally, I can say that some of the work that we've been doing with our clients is really focused on this area, as the requirement for understanding, if you will, the value of your value-based transformation is becoming more, or is receiving more pressure from organizations. Getting more sophisticated in how you measure and what you measure is becoming a growing importance of these programs. But with that said, I think there are a lot of challenges. I think the first that I would point to is this concept of easy to say, really hard to do, the bidirectional nature of data sharing, both from the payer and the provider. I think to Dan's earlier point of there are some structural challenges that are out there, but I think this is an advantage that HPA plans have over non-HPA plans. And one example I think that we've seen is, you know, from a non-HPA plan is really having to do something very, very simple to at least try to help their provider partners. And that is as simple as just providing some very high-level information and analytics on claims data in a reporting dashboard where the provider plan can actually really comb through the results themselves. It's not telling them where to fish and where to fix, but at least is providing transparency. And I think that's probably a good example of where the industry is at. And then I think a lot of, you know, what's out there in the market and you go to conferences is about, I will call it the 2025 version of data sharing. But I think, you know, the reality is what we're seeing in market is kind of baby steps are what's being impactful. Another example from a case study, would be of a plan who tried to and did successfully set up EMR sharing with their PCMH providers. It was a great success, and one of the plans that reported the ability to measure positive outcomes. The challenge they faced actually was the expectations of the providers. So as soon as you get a little bit, they want more. And as soon as they start relying on some of your analytics, they basically come to the point of, I need to be able to rely on it in real time. And there's a lot of challenges of bringing EMR data and claims data together and making real time to support their clinical decision making. And while they've had great success and probably one of the more successful examples that I've seen in market of data sharing, it created its own new set of challenges that I don't think was anticipated on the front end. So I think there's a lot of opportunity that remains out there in terms of how clinical and administrative claims data are shared and brought together to help really release the value of these programs. But I think the near term is much more about the simple steps that can be taken to get the momentum moving forward, if you rather than trying to get to that ultimate step in the next 18 to 24 months.
I want to add one last point on Casey's case study, because I found this one to be really interesting. He and I interviewed the same plan. They indicated that they have spent or invested over $40 million in HIE and other data infrastructure. Now, that's a long-term investment with the payoff down the line. And this simple little approach they took as far as sharing claims data and the systems that they were partnered with, they licensed Tableau. I'm not sure if you guys have heard of that, but it's just an easy interface that sits on top of a database that would allow someone to do some analytics on a very visual and understandable way. And the simple act of giving the system access to that data that they never got before because they just got canned reports, but now they have real-time access to it and can generate their own insights from it. It was an amazing positive impact in terms of trust and beginning to strengthen the integration and ties between the organizations. And that was probably, you know, 0.1% of the cost of that $40 million that they're investing in an HIE, which I think is going to be critical down the line, but it's just going to take time. So I think the juxtaposition of those two tactics really stood out to us as, to Casey's point, baby steps, and sometimes those baby steps can be effective.
And I think it's an important point, too, because we know a lot of plans are smaller, and so the idea of an analytic investment of $40 million, and while there are some plans in the room who've talked about great system commitment they've had to build these platforms, we know not everyone has that. So I think the point is, you know, don't let perfect stand in the way of good. There's small steps that you can take to kind of share this data, which really addresses a huge need on the provider side. And can start to put you on some of the paths to some of those successful outcomes. So as we wind down, we wanted to kind of give a kind of a quick summary, you know, of what did we hear that drove positive outcomes in value-based payment, and what do we think, you know, you as HPA plans should do about this? So, you know, in recap, longer length of time value-based payment does lead to success. You know, we have to give ourselves the runway for these programs, have the organizational commitment for it, At the same time, back to our point about measuring success, we have to have a clear understanding of what it is we're trying to do. And while we give ourselves enough runway to do it, we do need to have that metric there to be able to look at it and say, is it achieving the goals that we want it to, and should we take a different path? But certainly, giving ourselves the time, you know, is important. We talked about the percentage of the provider panel and having enough of that market share, wallet share of the providers, you know, is important to be successful. However, hopefully we did provide some, you know, examples and case studies and alternatives of some things that we're seeing of plans and what they're doing to mitigate that challenge. And certainly one opportunity to mitigate that challenge is through capabilities. You know, we see the healthcare management suite as really what we call table stakes to really being successful. You know, just as a data point, at least 90% of plans who reported success in cost and quality indicated that this suite of network data and medical management was effective. So there's a high association between those things and positive outcomes and value-based payment. On the flip side, market segments aren't necessarily associated one way or another. You know, said another way, it's not like being in Medicare Advantage led plans to be more successful in value-based payment than ASO. So not an association, but as we talked about, certainly an important factor to consider in the design of these programs and how we execute. And finally, you know, we really view product and benefit design as a really important but potentially underused lever for these models. And just in contrast, you know, we talked about 90% of the plans who had positive outcomes. You know, we saw about 70% of the plans who had positive outcomes in cost and quality saying that product and benefit design was effective. In contrast, the plans who said we haven't seen success in cost and quality, only 17% of those saw product as successful. So certainly folks who are not involving product and benefit design in their value-based payment are having some challenges in getting them to the point that they want to with cost and quality. So, you know, what do these takeaways mean as far as what you want to think about or do with your programs? You know, in our perspective, taking advantage of the advantages that you have as a provider affiliated entity as it relates to care transformation, ability to data share is certainly something to think about. Hey, can we double down? Let's continue our investments and find innovative ways to do that to offset some of the challenges that we might have because we're a smaller percentage of our panel. If you're already doing those things, we would certainly say, don't forget about product and benefit design. And if you're not doing anything, this is the opportunity to think about, let's bring product and benefit design into the fold with healthcare management as we design our programs. Because we certainly think that it's a great way to get that member engagement, drive that behavior change that's needed. And the final piece goes back to kind of the piece that Casey talked about earlier. You know, we have MACRA, kind of timing is everything. Now may be a really good time to use MACRA, as well as the investments that we talked about in healthcare management and product and benefit design to accelerate the roadmap to risk. You know, we know it's a chicken or an egg. We want providers to assume more risk. But providers, rightfully so, are going to push back and say, well, I can't do this if I don't have the data, if I don't have the enabling capabilities, if your products are open PPO where people can go to any specialist even though I'm telling them they don't need to. So if we use the product and benefit piece, if we use the healthcare management piece, and we educate them, the idea of MACRA and the program there, those things may kind of come together to really be a nice, all the ingredients we need in the recipe and the timing maybe a good one to help us, you know, accelerate some of the models that we have, that we see them being more on the left-hand side over to more of the risk-bearing side of the equation. So where do we go from here with the survey? You know, as we mentioned, this is certainly our initial sharing of findings. We very much appreciate the feedback that people have given us and some of the double clicks that might be good for us to do as we go back and look at the data. Next step is to kind of continue to integrate a couple findings, do a bit more analysis, kind of pull together the final report that we will, of course, issue to the Alliance and everyone here will have access to. The other piece is that folks who participated in the survey have the opportunity to do more of a individual session with us, where we'll take some of these findings that we talk about, which as Dan talked about, are thematic, but we can take them back down to what we heard from you about your specific medical management programs that you told us about your specific value-based payment model arrangements, about specific things you're doing in product and benefit design, and hopefully we can have a helpful and informative dialogue on what we saw in the survey and how that kind of translates to what you specifically as a plan are doing, which may be some more customized feedback, which we think folks will hopefully find useful. And again, that's a complimentary value-add service offering that we're offering to the Alliance and for plans who were gracious enough to give us their time and participate in the survey.
One other thing I'll say is if you didn't participate and you want to, we can certainly wrap your data into our database and ultimately our final findings. So we know we got a great cross-section of the HPA, but if others in here are hearing about this for the first time and would like to jump in, we'd love it if you would.
Final questions from folks? You've been trained to wait for the microphone.
So I guess going back to your slide that shows sort of the foundational elements, it's sort of the execution slide. So yeah, the execution drivers. So I'm curious in sort of you described the integrated care transformation as sort of the classic medical management function. And I think it was yesterday we heard sort of the declining return associated with sort of your classic medical management infrastructure, going to more supportive models than sort of restrictive models.
Sure.
So I guess one question is there more depth to this that really talks about the effectiveness of sort of those strategies and where people are in that integrated care transformation bucket,
Let me clarify, because I think our point of view is that this is significantly different and greatly contrasting from historical medical management, which I would define as much more of the UM prior auth retrospective review model, right? Now, certainly as the transition happens, those pieces may be even contractually stipulated, and you're going to want to keep elements of that in terms of a legacy model. But what we see and what we believe is going to be the future is what we're defining as integrated care transformation, which I think, as Alexis mentioned, could take on a lot of different flavors. But specifically, some of the things that we're seeing as successful, I'll give an example and certainly jump in, is care models around integration of medical and behavioral health. There's certainly great evidence out at the University of Washington where a lot of these models have been really tested, and we're seeing it in different markets across the country where people are starting to embed clinical resources in primary care settings, licensed social workers, psychiatrists who are kind of running point on care teams and really being part of that integrated model. That's a good example of a different way of doing things. It's not telephonic anymore. It's much more high touch. Now, certainly you have to be judicious in how you deploy your resources, and that's where risk stratification models come into play so that you can allocate scarce resources in the right way. But take that model and you can apply that to a transitions of care program or an ED avoidance where you're embedding a navigator in the clinical setting. Those are examples that where we see certainly the market going, certainly part of the market that are more progressive. So that's when we say integrated care transformation, that's what we mean. Yep,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So and I guess the other question is and we overused this phrase, I think, in the 90s, sort of the alignment of incentives. So frequently in provider-sponsored plans, there can be a difference in the performance of, quote-unquote, your employed physicians versus sort of your IPA independent practitioners, and in large part because the IPA docs feel that risk transfer on a day-to-day basis on their revenue and on their return, whereas sort of in the employed medical group side, it's sort of coming in at the tax ID and then it's filtering down based on a work RVU model or something like that. Did you get any sort of, is there any of that in terms of the transformation of physician compensation that is really as much a driver in the transformation and the engagement as anything?
We joke internally. So to answer your question, that's not something we probed in the survey. But to build on what you're saying,
I'd like to. I think
we talk internally that this is a huge next generation. We don't necessarily do physician compensation as a firm, but I think it's a huge opportunity because if you think about these value-based payment models and where they're going and the traditional way that physicians are compensated, both an employed salary basis or some kind of RVU basis, there's a huge disconnect between what we want, the objectives for value-based payment and the compensation today of physicians.
And I think most big delivery systems, their legal departments are pretty hesitant for there to be any sort of significant relationship between the risk and the compensation for fear of, rewarding utilization performance as opposed to quality.
Yeah, certainly there's a lot of headlines today of things, the unfortunate things that were going on at Swedish Hospital up in Washington and the recent United cases that were talked about when it relates to risk adjustments. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of challenges. That said, I do think, my opinion, that there's opportunities to probably reframe the compensation model within those legal guardrails.
Questions or comments or did it resonate with you? Some questions were asked, but does it resonate with you?
See a couple head nods.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much, both. You guys generated this idea, came to us with it. Thank you very much for all the effort and energy. We know, again, you're still continuing to kind of digest the information and take a look at additional insights that can be gained. So we'll hear more over the next couple of months. If your plan didn't participate in the survey, they can, their information can be. If you don't know for sure if your plan did, ask us and they'll know. And then take advantage of their offer to meet with you on a customized discussion on the initiatives and strategies that you're working on and what's working and what's not working. So thank you, guys. Appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you.